You are listening to WDOT Port Washington. Hello, and welcome back to the final episode of the Epic Entertainment Roundup for the school year. As always, I will be your host, Gabriel. For today's show, I will be speaking to Schreiber graduate Michael Whitehorn, an accomplished screenwriter, director, and producer. I hope you enjoy. Hi, Michael. Thanks so much for coming on the show today.
Hi, Gabe. My pleasure.
Could you tell me a little about yourself?
I grew up in Queens, New York until the age of about 10, and then moved to Port Washington, where I went to went through the remainder of elementary school and then junior high at Weber and then Schreiber, graduated Schreiber in 1974, about 50 years ago, almost exactly from when we're speaking right now, and went to Swarthmore College in Philadelphia. And then immediately after that, went to Los Angeles to pursue a career in television sitcom writing, which after I actually taught high school in L.A. for 3 years while I was, you know, trying to break in. And then I finally was able to get into the TV business writing in 1981. And, you know, I was very, very active in television for several decades. And then about 15 years ago, I did a film that I wrote and directed, and I just actually completed doing a second film, and finishing that up right now. So I've been in on the West Coast, Los Angeles. I actually live in Santa Barbara now, moved a few years ago, but I was in Los Angeles for 40 plus years, working primarily in television, but somewhat in film as well.
When you were in high school and in Weber, did you ever think that you were going to be in the place that you are today as a writer?
I did, or at least I fantasized about it. If you, I don't know if there's a room at Schreiber that has the old yearbooks, but in the 1974 yearbook under my picture, it says aspires to be a comedy writer. And it was really the only career goal I ever had. I very early on, have you ever seen the old Dick Van Dyke Show?
I have.
That show really inspired me in a number of ways when I was a kid. You know, first, it was just a great show, and I just loved watching it and the way it was done and everything about it. But also, Dick Van Dyke's character, Rob Petrie, his job in the show was comedy writer. And, you know, some of the scenes took place at his office with the other writers, and right? And there was just something about that really captured me and that phrase, comedy writer, I said, that's what I want to do. That's what I want to be. And I just had that vision. I didn't know anything about it or how a person gets into it or anything. I sort of figured that out step by step, but that was always my direction. And at Schreiber, I may be getting ahead of your questions, but I started writing like a column for the Schreiber Times, a comedic column that was sort of very much in the vein of Woody Allen at that time. Used to write, in addition to his filmmaking, he used to write comedic essays that were published in the New Yorker magazine, which were, you know, brilliantly funny. And so I sort of copied his style and applied it to different things going on at Schreiber. And so I started my comedy writing of a sort, at any rate, at Schreiber.
Did you ever look at Dick Van Dyke and realize that you wanted to be on the screen, or was it really just like the behind the scenes that really pulled you in?
Yeah, no, I never had any thoughts of being an actor or performer. You know, I'm not particularly talented at it, but it also didn't appeal to me the same way. I like being the puppet master, you know, the idea of conceiving and creating and overseeing it, and the performers being just one of the pieces of the machine, you know, that you build. Was kind of more the way I always looked at it.
Mm-hmm. And so before you were talking about how you you taught for 3 years before getting into your first writing opportunity, and that was the TV show Benson, I believe?
Yeah, well, that was, it was just a freelance episode. I didn't work on the show beyond that. You know, there were sort of two, the business has changed so much, but back then there were writing staffs on shows that worked on that show, you know, for a full season, but there were also a lot of episodes that were parceled out to freelance writers who didn't work on the show but were hired to write a single episode. And in 1981, when I first got an agent and was trying to, you know, get my first job, she sent my script around. But there was, at that time, there had been a writer's strike, and the industry was sort of similar to now, in a sense. The industry was still sort of waking up and coming out of that writer's strike. Certain shows were back up and running, certain other ones weren't. And this show, Benson, liked my script and wanted me to write for it. And I had never seen Benson. It was actually a spinoff of a really great show called Soaked. And Robert Guillaume played a character on that show, and then they spun him off into Benson. And he had his own show, but it wasn't as good as Soap. But when I had the chance to get this job, I said, oh, back then there was no VCRs, there was no DVR, there was no anything. So I had to go to the office where they shot it, which was like about an hour drive from my house. And I sat in a room and they put tapes in a machine, and I watched Benson and learned enough to go come up with some ideas, and I sold an idea now. So that was my first professional writing job, yeah, on that show.
Yeah, so that actually leads me up to my next question. How do you come up with ideas for shows?
You know, it's an interesting question, and it's kind of hard to answer in the abstract, because it has to be the kind of thing that you just have a certain innate, you know, proclivity for. Like when you observe life and you, you know, some people notice, you know, smells, some people notice visuals, and they're artistic and they recreate it through their own consciousness. You know, I have always kind of had an eye for certain interesting and potentially funny interpersonal dynamics between people, or events that happen to people and the way they react. And I have always thought, like, oh, that's funny, or that could be funny, or what if this happened, or what if that happened? And my mind has always kind of gone that way. And so, you know, it's never easy to think of ideas if you're sitting down at a desk going, I'm going to think of ideas now. But I found often sometimes if you pay attention to what's going on in your own mind, you might be having an idea if you're just kind of tuned into yourself. And if you just think, like, I got in the habit some years ago. First, I had a little mini tape recorder that I carry around with me. Now, you know, obviously you can do that kind of thing on your phone. And I just, like, every, like, month or so, I look and I see I have, like, you know, 20 recordings I've made that I hadn't listened to since I made them. And I'll sit down and I'll play them all and go, oh, that one, that's pretty funny. Oh, that's dumb. You know, I'll just kind of see if there's anything usable in there.
Mm-hmm. And do you ever base shows off on, like, your own life?
Not literally. Not actually, like but many in sort of more general ways I do. I you know, if I, you know, you have experiences as a human in the world, and a lot of times, you know, dating or marriage or being a kid or vis-a-vis your parents, or a parent vis-a-vis your kids or coworkers, or all of these, you know, things, and I'll just kind of extrapolate out a certain, as I say, dynamics, you know, a certain kind of a relationship or a certain thing that can affect a relationship. And, you know, I just finished a movie, a making movie. And there was one plot element in the movie of a woman who's in her late 50s, married to a man who is 25 years older, who's now in his 80s and starting to get dementia. And when she met him, you know, in the story, he was, you know, in his 50s and vibrant and vital, and she was in her 30s. Some years ago, I had dinner with a couple like that, where the woman was, you know, 60-ish and the man was in his 80s. And I could see that's who they were, and that she was having some trouble with the fact that he was aging and he wasn't the man she had married. And that just stuck in my brain, and I made a note of it. And, you know, I eventually kind of formed a story around it, and, you know, and that was part of this movie that I wrote. So just from having had that dinner and watched this woman and seeing just a flicker in her eyes of how her life wasn't quite, you know, what it had been, and how she was struggling with that, you know, just kind of made an impression on me. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, I'll base things on my own life, not my literal life, but my life experience, I guess, is the short answer.
So I don't know where this fits in with the timeline of from Benson, but I read that you passed up the opportunity to become part of the original writing staff on The Late Night with David Letterman to work on Family Ties. Do you ever regret not working on the team for Letterman?
I don't regret it at all. That was after Benson. I got hired by this man Gary David Goldberg, who was doing a show about school teachers actually. And I had just been a school teacher. I had quit the job to try to be a writer. And Gary David Goldberg hired me because he liked my writing, but he also thought, oh, this guy was just a teacher. He might have some good ideas for that. And then that show, we finished making that show and we're waiting for it to air. And Gary was working out this new show that he wanted to do called Family Ties, which I actually liked better than the one he hired me for. And I could tell that he liked me and wanted to hire me on it if he could sell that. And at that time, while I was waiting, I got this offer because I had had a, you know, in those days, you know, you put together a packet of sketch material or, you know, funny thing. You know, I was trying to be a sitcom writer, but I was also trying to cover my bases. And I could get a job like on a show like Letterman, you know, that would be great. So I was being sort of proactive about that. And then I got that offer because it was the first show. It was the very first show he did on Late Night back in 82, I think it started. Before then that was on NBC, and then later he did the CBS one. But I've now been in LA at that point for a few years, and I was settled there, and it would have involved moving back to New York, number one, which I had mixed feelings about, but also really what I wanted to do was write stories. As much as I think it would be really fun to write, you know, kind of talk show type bits and all of that. I sometimes wonder what it would have been if I had done it, and that, you know, what direction my life would have taken. But I don't regret it. I certainly don't, you know, think I blew it and made the wrong decision. But it was an intriguing choice to have. It was a great choice to have after a year earlier I had been, you know, struggling and wishing and hoping I could break in, and now I had two very good things in front of me.
And as a writer, do you in the cast of Family Ties, I believe Michael J. Fox is in it. Did you get to work close with the actors and actresses in Family Ties like Michael J. Fox?
Yeah, I did. I was involved. You know, I stayed. I didn't go to New York to do Letterman. I stayed with Gary. He even though I was young and new, he really trusted me and allowed me to be in on all the early phases of Family Ties, including the casting. And so I was there when Michael J. Fox came into the audition as a starving young actor from Canada. And, you know, he was hired, obviously. And yeah, and I wrote many, many episodes of the show. And I actually focused on his character. Most of the episodes I wrote were sort of about the, because I was at that point in my mid-20s. And the parents in the show were like, you know, older and parents. And it wasn't, their life wasn't a life I could relate to from my own life, but Michael J. Fox's character Alex was in high school, and you know, it wasn't that long since I'd been in high school, and I could remember and draw on my own life, and so I was drawn to that character. And as it turned out, Michael was the most dynamic, you know, character. You know, he had a good cast, but he was the breakout kind of personality. So we had a good symbiosis for a few years there. About 4 years I was kind of the Alex writer. And so yeah, we were together. I was, you know, close friends with him during that time as well.
Was it surprising to see the places that he went, like after Family Ties?
You mean his film career and so
yes,
forth?
Yes, his large
I wouldn't say it was surprising. I wasn't really thinking at that point, like, oh, what's he going to do after the show? Because we were still, when Back to the Future was being made, you know, I don't know if you read the story behind how he came to be in Back to the Future, but it was, I'll tell it very briefly. They were shooting the movie with another actor in the lead, and they weren't happy. Steven Spielberg and Bob Zemeckis, who made it, were not happy. Meanwhile, we were in the middle of the season of shooting Family Ties. I think we were in the third season, and Spielberg called Gary Goldberg and said, is there any way Michael Fox can do our movie? And Gary's like, we're in the middle of shooting our season. You know, NBC is waiting for these episodes. They're airing them every week. You can't not do the show. But it was worked out that he actually would do Family Ties during the day and then shoot Back to the Future at night.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, and sleep for maybe 3 hours, somewhere in there, kind of thing. And so for several months he did that, and because he was, you know, this young, energetic, ambitious guy, you know, he was able to pull it off. So then Back to the Future came out, and, you know, that was a massive, massive hit, and he became instantly a movie star. So I hadn't really thought before that, like, oh, do you think I'll ever be a movie star? It hadn't really occurred to me, but clearly he had the goods, and he went on to have a really great career in film.
I'm just wondering, after Back to the Future, did the reviews and, like, ratings and viewership of Family Ties increase?
Well, it did increase, but more because, can't remember when, but I think in the third season, we were put on after The Cosby Show, and The Cosby Show was an instant mega hit, and we had been doing very well to that point. We were a well-rated show by the third season, but after we were put after Cosby, we became this, you know, this is probably amazing, you know, for someone in today's world, but back then there was no streamers, there was no cable, it was just three networks, that was it. If you turn on your TV for original programming, you had your choice of three networks, that was it. And so the ratings would rate, you know, who's watching what show. And for a period, I think in the fourth season, Family Ties got a 50 share of the audience, which meant that of all the televisions in America that were on at any particular, at that hour of the evening, half of them were watching Family Ties. And, you know, there's obviously nothing, even successful streaming series now, you know, I don't know, of all the people in front of their TV at any particular time, you know, was 0.5% are watching that streaming series, you know. So it was a very different era.
And after Family Ties, your career just started to grow. You know, you were on the writing team for Cheers, Ned and Stacy, Pursuit of Happiness, True Colors, and South Central. What was it like working on all those shows? And did you ever have, like, a favorite or, like, a favorite project you worked on?
Well, when I left Family Ties, I began creating shows. So Cheers, actually, I should point out, I was not on the staff of Cheers. I wrote an episode as a freelance writer, similar to how I did the Benson. So I wasn't on the staff of that, but I did have that one episode that I wrote. But the other things you mentioned were shows that I created or co-created and was the executive producer of. And so, yeah, I really, you know, that was my career, was being, you know, somebody who created and ran sitcoms. And I, you know, it was really, really hard work, but I loved it. You know, as I say in the Schreiber, the Schreiber yearbook, who aspires to be a comedy writer, I got my wish. And I really, really was so happy because it was what I would want to do anyway, even if I wasn't getting paid for it. It was like when I sort of started working the last few years, but I was still kind of trying to pursue things. And somebody said to me, what do you want to try to work anymore? Just retire, get a hobby. I said, but comedy writing is my hobby. See, that's the problem. So I can't stop. But favorite, I don't know. You mentioned Ned and Stacy, which I have to say was a show I really, really liked a lot. I don't know if you've ever seen it. I don't think it's streaming anywhere. I do know it's out on DVD, but nobody uses those anymore, do they? So it's not an easily accessible show, but that one I really liked a lot. I like all my shows. I don't think they were all as creatively successful, you know, as I might have hoped they would have been, or as each, you know, certain ones were more, you know, I think hit the mark more than others, or did better than others. But they all meant a lot to me, as because I just put so much of my life and energy into them all.
So before I start talking about King of Queens, I would just like to say that whenever, like, the past few years, I feel like the past three times I've been to my grandparents' house, every single time the King of Queens is on, they always say, come on, Gabriel, let's go watch it. So I'd like to point that out. Yeah, so in 1998, you created King of Queens. I love that show so much. Where did you get your ideas when writing that particular show? Is it just like what you said before?
You mean for the episodes?
Yeah.
The ideas for each episode? Very much so. You know, I also had a great writing staff. And that's key. You know, you can't really do a good show without, you know, good writers, great writers. And the thing about The King of Queens was that it was just about, you know, very deliberately, it was very much about just an ordinary couple. You know, the idea would be that, you know, I used to describe it like, you know, I always thought, like, any house you drive by or behind that door, there's a fascinating story. If you had access to it and would know what it was. And that was the idea here. You know, just this ordinary, it could be any house on the block, but it's this guy, you know, it's these characters. And, you know, one of the slightly unusual things was that but even not that unusual, is that the elderly parent lives with them. But, you know, even that's not a particularly unusual thing. But other than that, it's just all, you know, we were able to, all the writers and I were able to just sort of bring in things that happened to us that seemed like, again, that thing I was describing earlier, where just something about an event or an interaction or something just kind of sparks something, and you say, oh, if I sort of enhanced that and added to it and heightened it a bit, there would be a funny story in it. I remember just off the top of my head, as I was talking about, there was this wonderful writing team on the staff, Josh Goldsmith and Kathy Yuspa, who actually, you know, were huge parts of the success of the show. They came in one day, and one of them said, oh, I got a ticket. I'm late. I got a ticket on the way to work. And the guy, we just started talking about what it's like when you get a ticket, a traffic ticket, you know, and out of that grew in that, just that casual thing that they came in and were talking about this. There's an episode we did in the story that we, you know, people start to pitch, like, what could happen to make it an interesting story. And in this case, you know, someone suggested, well, you know, it's the wife that gets pulled over, and she's very pretty, and she's wearing gloves because it's cold, so the cop couldn't see her wedding ring, so he calls her and asks her out. And, you know, and well, what do you say? Well, she's married, so she'll say, well, I'm married, I can't. But, you know, it's her, like, fifth ticket, and their insurance rates are going to go through the roof. So her husband encourages her to just go out with the guy. don't let anything happen, but just go out with him just to get in his good graces. And then you contest the ticket, and then the day of court, he won't show up because he likes you. He's sweet on you, you know, and you'll get out of the ticket. So that was his scheme to get out of the ticket. It was a very funny episode. I don't know if it's one of the ones you happen to see, but that just came out of someone coming in one morning and saying, I got a ticket on the way to work. You know, it's the kind of thing. And so that some shows don't lend themselves to that because they're not about ordinary people in an ordinary life. But this one was, so it really lent itself to that.
Yeah, so like I was saying before, I recently your shows have been on the TV. And is it, like, crazy to see, like, years later that your shows are still running? And is it, like, kind of, like, surreal watching them on the television?
Well, the only one that's running now, I think, I know Family Ties might be running somewhere on some obscure streaming service, I don't know, but or maybe not obscure, I don't know, I just, believe it or not, I don't know if it's on or not, but The King of Queens, I know, is on multiple platforms now. It's actually done very, very well in syndication, meaning that after its initial network run, is there a market? Do people still want to see it in reruns for years, you know, in some shows? And you need to have, the show needs to have been successful in its network run to even have enough episodes to do that. Like the magic number used to be, if you got to make at least 100 episodes, that was enough to syndicate. Because if it's going to be on every night on, you know, channel 11, you can't do that with 20 episodes. They'll start repeating too often. So you need, you know, at least 100. So we did actually 207. So it was plenty of episodes. But yeah, the fact that it's still going, it really, really, really makes me feel good, because what it says to me is that, you know, that what was ultimately the heart of the show and made the show appeal to people was that it was about real human dynamics and relationships that don't age, you know, that they're as true at any point as they're always true, as opposed to, say, let's say a show that was on, I cite this one because it premiered the same year we did, and we looked at it a little bit like in a competitive way, was Will and Grace, which was more successful than us ratings wise at the time, but I don't think you can find it anywhere now. in syndication. And I think one of the reasons is because that show was very much of its time culturally. It was about, you know, the emergence of, you know, gay people coming out of the closet, and you know, and just the whole culture of that time that was happening in the late 90s. And that was fine. It was a good show, but it would probably seem very dated if you watched it today. Whereas I think the King of Queens, fortunately, other than maybe an odd reference here or there, or the fact that they still talk on a landline and other things like that, you know, probably still feels pretty current. Mm-hmm.
So over your career, you've had 5 Emmy nominations, all for Outstanding Writing in Comedy Series. What was it like to hear that you were nominated for an Emmy, and what was the feeling when you first heard about it?
Oh, it's a huge thrill. You know, even though, like, everybody knows that these awards are very, they're dumb. They're just kind of the industry's way. You know what it is, like, when you're not, like, currently, you know, up for an award or anything, you look at it, you know, if you have any sort of, experience in the business and know the business, it's just the industry's way of self-promoting itself. And, you know, it's all very cynical, and certain shows are favored over others and all these kinds of things. But then, you know, if you yourself are nominated, it's like, yay, woohoo! You know, you still get very excited. You know, it was a great thrill. You know, I was sort of, to be honest with you, you know, peeved I never won. There was one year that I really, really should have and didn't for whatever reason. But, so yeah, I can get petty about it. but no, it was, I mean, listen, my whole career, I feel like so, I've gone from a kid at Schreiber, like putting that in my yearbook to actually doing it. I feel like incredible gratitude that my life was able to go in that direction. You know, so I'm really, you know, I have nothing to complain about, you know what I mean? But still, if you mentioned an Emmy, I'll say, yeah, I should have won that one. Because everybody has their ego at some level.
Do you ever feel like the, like, I don't know, like, darker side of being a writer, like, stress from writing shows or, like, deadlines?
Oh, my God, yeah. No, it's incredibly stressful, especially, you know, running a show. You know, it's lonely at the top, and it is. You know, you have to answer to everybody. You know, everybody's looking at you for you know, the network, the studio, the actors, the other writers, you know, the production, you know, everybody's looking at you like, well, what do you want to do? And in the case of often with a network, they'll be pressuring to do the show. I don't like the way you're doing the show. Do it this way. Don't do it that way. And it can get very contentious. And, you know, you know, there were times when I just was exhausted and stressed and, you know, and very not in a good place. And it's really brutally hard work. But you know, listen, nothing comes easy. Nothing worth anything comes easy. And I never regret it. I never felt like I was being treated unfairly. You know, sometimes when people complain too much about some aspect of their work or what's happening in their careers, I'll say, or I'll think, you know, if I don't feel I want to say it to them, I'll say, like, this is what you chose. You chose this. This is the business you got into. No one promised you anything. No one promised to roll out a carpet for you. It's hard. It's really, really hard. And there are times when you get bitterly disappointed. You know, you mentioned all the shows that I was able to, you know, get launched. You know, there's more that I couldn't. And really, really, and even of the ones you mentioned, some of them I felt should have continued beyond when they did, and they got canceled, and you know, all these the losses really do hurt. But it's part of it. It's why you do it. You know, it's same as sports. You know, you don't win every game. But it's what you love to do. You just do it, and you accept, you know, what it takes to do it. But yeah, no, it was not easy, but it was still worth it in every sense.
Mm-hmm. So my final question for you today is just like some. Do you have any, like, general advice for a student that wants to become an actor, screenwriter, producer?
Yeah, I would say make stuff a lot. The great thing about today, you know, I was, you know, in the generation technologically where, like, the first film I made was in college with it was silent because There were, you know, I had no access to a sound, but I had a Super 8 camera and, you know, made a movie and edited it. You know, now, obviously, with your phone, you can make really, you know, put it on cinematic and you're going to have a, you know, get a little tripod or Steadicam kind of thing, and you can have a beautiful looking movie. You can make your own content. You can do your own sketches or films or animation. There's just so much technology available. So I would say just make stuff and don't worry if it's bad at first. Let it be bad. It's better to make bad stuff than not make anything because you're worried it's going to be bad. Because that's how you get better. You just do it. You learn from your mistakes. You say, oh, this is going to be great. You make it. Oh, it's not great. Why wasn't it great? Huh, what did I do wrong? What could have made it better? And you start asking yourself these questions and you start developing skills. And, you know, Malcolm Gladwell talks about the 10,000 hours, like to be really, really great at anything. There's no substitute for just, you know, doing it over and over and over and over in various ways over long periods of time. And so, you know, start on hour one of those 10,000 and start making something. So that would be my advice, is just do it. And feel what you're able to do and feel yourself learning and feel yourself getting better.
Well, Michael, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Sure. Are you still a Schreiber? Did you graduate?
I still, next year I'll be a sophomore. I have my final regions on Friday, and then we're out for summer.
Okay. Well, oh, great. Regions. I forgot about regions. Yeah, New York State. Well, anyway, it's been a pleasure talking to you, Gabe, and give my best to Mr. Began. I remember him so fondly. He was such a, he was the cool young teacher at Schreiber when I was there. and he was really very supportive of me. And I remember him very well and very fondly. He's a really good guy.
I hope you enjoyed that voicemail with him.
I did. Yeah, it was great to hear his voice again. All right. Well, give him my best and best to you and good luck.
Thank you so much. All of you people listening out there, this has been your host, Gabriel, saying have a great summer and have fun with your family.